Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, we're on the cusp of our midnight release, guys.
I know. It's exciting. It's exhausting already, but it's cool.
It is next week. The next time you hear our voices, you might be live in the store listening to us make a special podcast.
Yep.
You might be on the podcast.
Yeah, that's actually true. We're going to
be hours, if not minutes, away from finding out what DC Rebirth is all about.
Oh, yeah, there's that too.
And finding out the Joker's
real name.
Joker's real name. You're also going to find out what happened to the Robin who died in Dark Knight.
Oh, right. Wow. No.
That special is
hitting. No, that Dark Knight special is not hitting.
No, I lied.
It's been delayed. I kept meaning to tell you to stop telling people about it.
What?
People
it's been delayed.
It's been delayed. I know. Right. It seems crazy that a Dark Knight 3 would be delayed in any way.
All right. But I was right once upon a time.
Yes.
But you can also read the new exploits of Steve Rogers' Captain America.
Exactly, yeah.
Number one on that. Not to mention.
And find out what the Scooby Apocalypse is all about.
That's true. And then, of course, there's all the Marvel and DC releases that we're not thinking of talking about.
Yep.
They will be available as well.
Yeah, it's going to be huge.
It's going to be huge. And that is next week. Before we get to that point, though, this Saturday is our Gaming with Rogues. They're doing Betrayal House on the Hill.
Yay.
Reminder, if you have a Rogue card, it's 10% off on that game till the end of May.
We should take a brief moment to emphasize to people who do have the Rogue cards, these fine people, to remind us to flash it when you come up to the
Yes,
register.
You got to show us the cards, because while we do know a lot of you that have the cards,
we realize it slipped past once or twice.
Well, we can't know.
Yes.
We do our best, like we see someone we know come in, it's a file, we remember to grab their file and stuff, but we can't keep in our head who is a member, who's not.
Yep.
So you need to flash the card if you want the discounts and stuff.
Yep. Flash card, we'll apply it, and we'll high-five you.
Yes. You might. You never know.
Yep.
All right, then moving on into June. June's another packed month. We've got our Ladies' Night on June 7th. That's going to close early at 7 o'clock on that Tuesday. And from 7 to 9, it is Ladies' Night.
Yep.
And from about 7:30 to a little after 8, Kelly Sue DeConnick is going to Skype in and answer questions. And if you have a question that you want to ask Kelly Sue and you ask it, you will get, according to the limited supply, either a Bitchplant hardcover or a signed copy of Bitchplant 1 through 5.
That's super cool.
Yeah, so big feature. If you're a Kelly Sue DeConnick fan or you know someone who is, spread the word. We're hoping to make a big deal out of this.
Yes.
Then the next Tuesday, June 14th, is Reading with Rogues. That is going to be our bi-monthly graphic novel club. We're going to be talking about Doctor Strange the Oath, which is 15% off the rest of this month. 25% off if you get a Rogue card. And next month it's going to be Saga Volume 1.
Yep, all things Vaughn.
And then June 18th, that Saturday, is Free RPG Day. And June 25th is our All Ages Awesomeness, which you can go to our website and see what the rundown is. We're going to have about eight artists here to just sketch and sign and talk to about comics. So should be fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we have a ton of news this week.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna dive in. We're gonna hit it, and we'll get to as much as we can. So first of all, top of the story is the biggest news this week, which is Darwin Cook.
Oh yeah, jeez.
Which sucks. For those who don't know, Darwin Cook, the writer artist of DC New Frontier, the Parker graphic novels from IDW, any number
got
of
his
awesome
start in animation. And if you ever watch Batman Beyond,
yep.
I believe he storyboarded or built that sequence.
The opening sequence.
Yeah.
Yes. Darwin is a guy who's he was probably my favorite cartoonist.
Yeah.
And, honestly, he was a friend. I've met him a few times. He was always a really good guy. And, he died of cancer this week. Sort of suddenly, he'd clearly been fighting it for a while, and his family had been keeping it quiet, and they...
Kind of a private guy, imagine.
So there's been very much an outpouring of support for him, and we've... I've gone through my collection of stuff, and am finishing up any holes I have in my collection, so I pretty much own everything Darwin's done.
Yeah.
He is, like I say, my favorite cartoonist. If you've never read his stuff, the best excuse I can give you to go ahead and give it a chance something.
Here's a question. If you had to recommend one to our listeners to pick up, maybe, what would you recommend?
New Frontier.
Dave? Yeah.
I think I would probably also go New Frontier, but I don't think I can do just one. And the cool thing with Darwin is that you can easily kind of target a few different areas. Like, if you like crime fiction, for sure the Parker stuff. I mean, yes. If you've been reading Ed Brubaker or Greg Rucka's crime stuff over the years, pick up the Parker things. They're amazing. If you're a superhero guy, then you've got New Frontier. But I would also recommend, and I'm not sure where the if this is collected or somewhere, his Catwoman graphic novel. His
Catwoman is collected. It's Ed Brubaker wrote. He designed the new Catwoman costume, which is, for my money, the best Catwoman costume that's been done. Yep.
It's very much stuck around, too. They've tweaked it at times, yeah. But the basics have stuck around.
But that volume, that Catwoman is available. We have that. There's also the Graphic Inc. hardcover that's all of his work at DC, which mm-hmm. is really, really nice. There's his Batman Ego and Other Tales, which is just his Batman work.
If, for those who aren't familiar with his style, he was the fact that he did Batman Beyond will get you there. But Bruce Timm, who did all the Batman animated series in the 90s,
yeah.
they share a kinship of style, and yeah. probably were almost certainly both influenced by the same artists over the decades. But it is a sort of clean line, classic cartoonist style, wed with like illustrator sensibilities. He was kind of an artist's artist, yeah. which is to say that he wasn't a superstar, but like if you he kind of was though too, like mm-hmm. artist to artist, he was a superstar.
The outpouring of support for people on Facebook and Twitter and all that has shown you exactly where Darwin was in the industry, not only as an artist, but he was somebody that people really liked. He was a good guy. He was a straight shooter.
It's when we lose somebody like that, it is always heartbreaking, but there is something cathartic about like say when Bowie died and stuff like that, just the sheer love.
Yeah.
You know, the amount and then the recognition, you know, it's there's no solace to the family or anything like that, or to just losing him as a person. But the memories that people have just remind you how important this person was to him.
Yeah. All right, close your kids' ears for a second. Fuck cancer. All right.
Yeah.
Moving on, comic-wise, Darth Vader, the series we've all been enjoying, is yep. ending at issue number 25.
Yeah.
Now, when I first read this, I thought...
You thought canceled.
I thought Marvel canceled it, and I couldn't wrap my head around it.
No, because it's a top-selling book.
It sells great for us, but then I read the article a little bit closer. Kieran Gillen is coming to a conclusion with his story, yeah. and instead of keeping it going and kind of meandering a bit... He just wants it kind of, that's the end.
Well, I think Marvel's smart to do that because not that Darth Vader couldn't do many, many other stories, but Kieran Gillen's take has been really good. And when you get a good story like that, you close it off. You finish the run.
And there is sort of an arc to it all, which is to say it's sort of broadly, I mean, there's other things going on, but it's broadly dealing with him and the Emperor after he fell out of favor after the destruction of the first Death Star. And things he's done to work himself back into the Emperor's favor, things he's done, you know, working kind of against him at odds with him at times, and his private agenda. But it is sort of an arc.
Yeah, and I know, isn't 25 like double sized or some?
Probably so. It's a big ending.
It's a big ending.
You know, I think the thing, if they're smart, what they'll do is they'll rest it for a year or two, and then maybe do a new Darth Vader series that takes place between Empire and Return of the Jedi.
Okay, cool.
I can see that. And you know, they did I don't know if they said that or is this something we said, but Vader Down was also a kind of a culmination storyline.
Yeah.
You know, just
yeah.
as far as like if you wanted to see Vader just unleashed Vader as badass, that story will get you what you want.
Yeah. No, I'm all for a good close-ended run. So this is good news. Finally, the weirdest headline I've seen in a while.
Yeah.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is coming to write Mycroft Holmes for comics.
Yeah, yep.
Which is not as crazy as I first thought.
Yeah, no, see, when you posted that, I was thinking that I already heard this. Like, I remember hearing this a year or two ago. And then I looked it up and I was reminded, oh, right, he has actually written a novel about Mycroft Holmes before. Mm-hmm. And not only that, for those who don't sort of follow him or who haven't followed him, he's a political commentator these
days.
Yeah,
I hadn't realized it, but when I posted sort of the, wow, this is a crazy headline, a bunch of my friends were like, actually, he's a really good writer.
Yeah.
And so now I'm kind of legitimately excited to see it. I think it's IDW doing it.
Yep.
And it's going to be adapted. It's like, I don't know how involved he is in writing it, but just Kareem Abdul-Jabbar writing comics is crazy.
It is crazy.
But Mycroft Holmes is an interesting character.
Yeah. I've heard him. I've heard an interview with him, like on NPR or something like that, when the novel was coming out. He was talking about his love for Sherlock Holmes,
yeah,
and like how it's kind of woven throughout his whole life. He's really passionate about it. Like it is not some idle thing. He loves the character. He knows him back and forth.
Yeah,
and he knows the original Arthur Conan Doyle stuff. And in general, I would recommend look up any of his like. political commentary on YouTube. He's a sharp dude.
To divert briefly from comics, we're going to switch over to TV anyway, but staying on Sherlock Holmes, I see that Toby Jones is going to be in season 4 of Sherlock.
Yes.
And he's playing, they said he's playing an established villain. So I don't know Sherlock Holmes' villains that well. I know Moriarty and that's
yeah,
it. Does it. Do you guys know?
Craven the Hunter?
No, that's Spider-Man villains.
Oh.
Yeah.
Calendar Man?
No, that's Batman villains.
Oh man, I'm not good at this.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, no, I'm afraid I don't know, I don't know my classic Sherlock Holmes stuff enough to know anybody outside of like Moriarty as like a...
Okay, so yeah, we don't know who it'll be, but I'm curious to see, and the way they reinvented Moriarty was...
Toby Jones.
That's the thing, Toby Jones is awesome.
Yeah, Toby Jones is awesome. Toby Jones was big in Wayward Pines.
Yep. Also Captain America.
So he's done TV before.
And one of my favorite things is, God, but I forget what the name of the character was on the Doctor, on Doctor Who.
No, I forgot it was in Doctor Who.
He was like his evil opposite or his shadowy nightmare version thing.
Is he the Master?
No, he wasn't the Master. It was like he was like a creation of his subconscious.
Oh, huh. I don't remember this one.
I think it was a one-shot episode, but what I remember about it is that he gets under the Doctor's skin as few other people do, and he kind of really takes him down a peg, almost on a meta level. He's like, oh, you're such a carefully constructed, weird personality.
Uh-huh.
He like spoofs and like mocks all of the Doctor's quirks that, fans love, but, are sort of, are these affectations, and he really, he gets to him.
Okay. Well, speaking of Captain America, Agent Carter is no more.
Yeah.
I think we all kind of saw this coming.
I mean, it was pretty obvious when she was announced to be heading another ABC project.
Yeah. I still thought she could have done two shows. But
it's tough.
But yeah, Agent Carter is canceled, and the most wanted spinoff that was going to feature Bobby Morse and Lance Hunter and Dominic Fortune with Delroy Lindo playing him.
That would have been awesome.
That is not happening now. I'm actually more upset about that news than Agent Carter not coming back.
Yeah, honestly, I think two seasons for Agent Carter is not bad.
No, it's not bad.
I would have liked to see more, but I think I'm happy with what we got.
There's a big Netflix petition running to have
that
Netflix save it. I don't see that happening.
Especially not since she's already got a show.
Yeah, but the other thing that's interesting about this is everybody's made much about Ike Perlmutter in charge of Marvel.
Yeah.
He's still in charge of the TV division. Ike Perlmutter is still one of these backwards, old-school guys who doesn't think women sell comics.
Or toys.
He's one of the reasons why the Black Widow toy thing happened.
Yeah.
And there's been some speculation that, Most Wanted was a Mockingbird-fronted show. Agent Carter is canceled. Is it possible that he – and yet Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is – not great, continues to go forward, and it's like, is it like Perlmutter's hand in it? And I think it could be. I know that
we're just wildly guessing here. But.
I mean, there's also the article that just came out that Shane Black was talking about, where the villain Rachel Hall was that her character? Well, she was supposed to be the villain. She was supposed to secretly be the Mandarin
for Iron Man 3,
yeah. And he's like, yeah. He's like, I don't know if it was Ike, but, could have been. And it really sounded like what he was saying was, no, it was Ike, but I don't want to say it because he's a powerful guy in Hollywood and I work in Hollywood. So I'm wondering if there is sort of a old school women don't buy comics, women don't buy toys thing going at Marvel that really needs to be rooted out.
Yeah.
How are ratings for
bad
Agent Carter?
Bad. Very bad.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there's a legit reason why this got canceled.
Okay.
What people have wondered, and I think is the legit wonder, is why does this get canceled and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. continue? Why don't they just wipe it all clean?
Are the ratings still okay for that?
No.
Eh.
They're better than Agent Carter, but they're not great. Yeah. So for some reason, they've hitched their star to, what, 4 seasons of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.? Yeah. That's crazy.
Maybe because even though it does not seem to interact much with the movies now, it is the most likely to at some point.
It's never gonna.
You don't think so?
I saw Chloe Bennett coming out sort of complaining about that there was sort of a wall between Marvel TV and movies.
Yeah, no, I saw that. I'm just wondering if, like, behind the scenes, if there's still talk, basically enough momentum on the possibility that that's why it's still got game.
I think Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. would have had to have been considerably more successful for them to have any interest in integrating the Marvel Cinematic Universe into it.
I
think it's probably for the best that they don't.
In a weird turn of events, didn't they announce that The Inhumans is going to be slated as a movie?
I didn't see this.
Oh, yeah.
I heard him say that it was definitely still on their plans,
They were just trying to fit it in.
But that was
that's face saving. Come on.
It was in that sort of very general way.
Dave and I were talking about this the other day, and I believe, and I don't know anything. I don't know the inside on this. And I've been wrong before, but I believe what's going on is that they're hoping to get the X-Men back. They're seeing what their Spider-Man deal is doing. They're happy with it, and they're seeing that the X-Men stuff is getting bad buzz, and maybe there's stuff going on behind the scenes. And what they're thinking is, oh, let's take Inhumans off the table, and then if we get X-Men back, we won't bother with it. And if we don't get X-Men back, we'll put Inhumans back on the schedule.
Maybe.
Because I believe Inhumans is always meant as an X-Men replacement. But the good news in TV, superhero TV, is that Supergirl is renewed.
Yes.
It's moving to the CW.
Yep.
But it is getting a 22-episode season. This was announced, by the way, by David Harewood. Or not announced, but David Harewood, a.k.a. Martian Manhunter, announced it on Twitter, which probably is a good indication that he will be sticking with the show.
Yeah, that's awesome. He's been a strong addition to that.
And the speculation on it has been, I saw an article on Comic Book Resource where they speculate, well, what does this mean for Supergirl? Does it mean, are they going to shunt it over into the shared universe of Arrow, Flash, Legends of Tomorrow? Will Calista Flockhart be coming along? Because she's probably the most expensive cast member. And we're not sure she's going to work in Vancouver. What does this mean for the special effects? These are some of the big questions.
Yeah.
And Flash has done okay with limited budget.
Yeah.
I'm a little worried about it, but I'm not super worried about it. I love Cat Grant. I know some people don't. But if they had to write her out, I can see a way where sort of Supergirl has graduated to not needing this mentor anymore.
Yeah.
And they did give her, you know, I don't want to give spoiling for Dave because I know he's way behind, but they did give sort of a speech between the two of them at the end, I thought, that could have been the sort of farewell kind of thing.
I think I'm caught up.
Are you caught up?
Yeah, he caught up.
Oh, I forgot you were behind.
He's behind
on everything else.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were behind on it.
No.
Then you know what I'm talking about, that sort of moment between them where it was almost like, it seemed like almost a goodbye speech in some ways.
Right.
So I can see a new version of this where something happens where she goes in the Flash continuity and Cat Grant doesn't come with them or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, I do like Cat Grant. I could see how she could grate on people. She's still a very larger-than-life character,
yeah.
And her archness is a big part of her.
Yeah.
But I like it.
The other question is, do we want it in the Arrowverse? I kind of do, just to see, just hopefully it would lighten everything up.
Yeah.
Yeah, may as well.
Yeah, I feel like that Flash is an easy way to sort of have those worlds merge.
Yeah.
They could do it if they wanted to.
But then Superman is in the Flash and Arrow world, which is kind of weird.
It's true.
So, I don't know. I mean, I could see the CW keeping it separate.
I could see an amusing conversation where, somebody is like, when we flip this switch, Flash, you know, the worlds are going to merge when you do this. And you're going to suddenly have memories you didn't have before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you could actually have some fun in the scene where the memories begin forming in here.
Yeah.
They're like, I'm, you know, not, you know, the world's first metahuman. I'm like,
right.
You know, they've been around.
Yeah.
And you could play around with it, I think. Actually, the merging could be a thing.
Yeah.
You know, its own series of storylines.
Maybe so. We'll see. I'll be curious to see how they incorporate it. I would love to see more Supergirl. I would love to see her tie in with the Arrowverse.
I mean, it could be as simple also as, of course, she just crosses over into his world.
Yeah.
And her world goes to hell.
Well, see, that's the thing. I don't want her to lose her supporting cast.
Yeah.
Although, if they are having
to
cut back...
Well, they could all come over for a storyline.
If they were cutting back, that would be the easiest way to do it. Supergirl goes in and suddenly she's on the CW universe and has to start over. But they wouldn't want to lose Alex. And I don't think you want to lose Martian Manhunter.
And I wouldn't want to see Jimmy Olsen, James...
I'd be okay with it, but I don't really want to. I don't want to lose him or win, honestly.
Yeah. I bet they'll find a way to bring him.
I mean, they probably will. Well, we'll see. But it's interesting speculation, and mostly the thing is, it's good news. There's also a new show on Netflix that looks interesting to me. It's Altered Carbon.
Yeah.
This is Richard K. Morgan, who's another one of the cyberpunk pioneers. His cyberpunk series that was about... people living on in other bodies, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's sort of like ritual elitists and sort of keeping themselves around for ungodly amounts of time.
Have you read it?
I have. I did read this. I got it confused momentarily with another book. But no, I have read this, and it's sort of about a special operations officer that kind of gets involved in a bigger scheme. It was really good.
Okay.
I enjoyed it quite a bit.
It's the special op, the lead guy is played by Joel Kinnaman.
Yes.
Who's really good.
Yeah.
And it's being... directed and shown by Miguel Sapochnik, who has directed a bunch of Game of Thrones.
Yep.
So it's got a really good pedigree. And like a cyberpunk TV series is something I've been wanting for a while. And Netflix is the people I want to do it. So I'm kind of excited about this. I think this is either later this year or early next.
Well, I think Netflix is just getting a ton of, original shows that are kind of badass.
Yeah. So. Yeah. All right. I want to divert over more TV, but let's talk about 24 Legacy.
All right. Yeah. The by the way, is it a Legacy in the same sense? Is it in the 24
it
universe?
Is? Yes, it is.
Okay. Yep. So Jack Bauer could show up at some point if they want.
I was wondering about that, and I feel like he might because he's the executive producer on it.
Yeah.
But I felt like in some ways it looked a little more polished than the old CTU.
It does.
It felt more sort of
movie-ish
in some ways.
Yeah, a little bit less TV budget. Yeah.
You guys all watched the trailer, right?
Yes.
Okay, so it's, who's the lead?
He's the guy from...
He's from Straight Outta Compton, I'm blank on his name.
Yeah.
Who was he in Straight Outta Compton?
He was Dre, right? Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that guy was great.
And he's... I love...
Sort of an ex-military guy that went on a secret mission.
So what they're doing, and I like this, they're tying in the president thing, but it's not an assassination thing. Yeah. At least that's where... So,
the president is former CTU, right?
The president's president's
first
wife.
Lady.
Oh, right.
So the president is... no, not the president. The guy who's running for president
right.
is Jimmy Smits.
Yes.
Which is funny, because doesn't Jimmy Smits become president in the West Wing?
He does.
Okay. So that's typecasting Jimmy Smith. He's going to be president. He's going to get that Morgan Freeman thing going. And his wife, they're sort of trying to use for political gain. They're using her. She had a big success. It was almost like a Killing Bin Laden kind of thing. Ibn Ibrahim or something like that. So she was head of CTU.
Yeah.
And she was head of this operation that sent CTU agents and this Army Rangers team in to kill this guy. And one of the Army Rangers is our lead character. And it seems like what happens is that Ibrahim's people find out and are launching revenge schemes against these guys who are sort of in hiding.
I mean, it felt like a classic 24 kind of story.
It's what would happen. It's like it's a what if Bin Laden's guys went after SEAL Team 6.
Yeah.
Right.
This
guy seems maybe a little bit more military-ish than Jack. Jack felt more like CIA.
But I did find it humorous in the trailer that he had the sort of the thing Kiefer Sutherland always had. He had like the gear that he would like throw over his shoulder and run around with. And
I don't know what you're talking about.
Are you talking about like...
It's like his little knapsack that he to throw over.
His go bag?
His go bag. That he
I didn't notice that, actually.
Kiefer always had one in his in every season.
Now, the one thing I couldn't quite tell from this, and I don't know if this... are they sticking to the conceit of 24, which is it takes place in real time?
Yes, I believe they are. I believe they're doing the takes place in real time, which I think is a good idea.
Yeah.
I'm a little worried about going back to 24 episodes, because 12 works so well for Live Another Day.
Yeah.
It can certainly stretch the material.
But it also looks like this guy has a wife who's maybe going to be sort of along for the ride, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And that he's in contact with his old boss... And it's like, it seems like somebody at CTU is a traitor. I know that sounds crazy. I don't want to...
There's a mole?
I believe that basically, it sounds like somebody at CTU basically sold out their information to this terrorist. Yeah, yeah. And that they're going to be on the run. And he's going to be working with his old boss who she can't trust her structure. And it looks interesting. It looks like kind of a fun flip on the 24 where you've got the sort of woman who's at the head of CTU, who's maybe his Chloe, but she's not. She's more of like a, I don't know, Tony?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's what we haven't seen from 24 before, but in the same way it is what we've seen, so I'm excited about it.
I'm mildly excited, but I also, to some degree, I'm kind of like, I feel like I've gotten enough 24.
I had, and then that 24 Live Another Day got me back.
It
so.
Was to me it was just like a really good wrap.
Yeah.
Except for its last 5 minutes.
Eight seasons of 24 was enough for you, sir?
I skipped some of those seasons.
Yeah, me too. But no, I'm kind of excited for this.
I'll try it out. I know that like 24 often does a good gangbusters first episode.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so moving on to... let's take some movie news, I guess. The Black Panther movie is shaping up.
Yeah, they've got an amazing cast on that one.
Lupita Nyong'o from Force Awakens.
Yep. Yep.
And Michael B. Jordan from Creed are now in it.
Was she also in 12 Years a Slave?
I think she was.
I think she was. And she was amazing in that.
So Black Panther's going to be great. I feel confident in forecasting that now. And the cast is just spectacular. I'm really looking forward to that movie.
Yeah, I don't know like how they could have put together a better team on it. Everything is set up because he was so awesome in Civil War. So, yeah, things bode well.
Yeah, and then other movie news. I see. D&D has a director now.
Yep. It's I forget the name, but it's the person who did Goosebumps.
Rob Letterman is his name.
Mm-hmm. And here's the funny thing. Like, the Goosebumps movie looked dumb to me from the trailers.
You can actually watch the Goosebumps movie yourself. It just went on Netflix.
Oh, did
interesting.
It?
Okay.
Well, and I actually will, because the thing about that is, like, every single person I know who's seen it from among my group of friends, mm-hmm. none of whom I trust, by the way. No. I trust them at various different degrees. Have all liked it. They said most everybody said it's fun.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. And I'm curious to
see
it.
Nobody's like, it's amazing. Yeah. They're all like, yeah, that was good.
And that may be exactly what we need for D&D. A solid, fun director.
Yeah, I do feel like, even if it's set in the Forgotten Realms, which is basically serious setting, I feel like a sense of humor that some of the ones that we've seen in the comics.
Boo and Minsk on the big screen?
Oh, we're not going to see Boo and Minsk.
Yeah, you know what? If they were smart and they did Marvel-style teasers, throwing them, they throw Drizzt in.
Yeah.
Throwing Drizzt in the end or something like that, or Minsk and Boo. Even in cameos, honestly, that would be a great cameo if they wanted to set up something like a follow-up movie.
So here's my both worry and potentially good. Goosebumps, instead of adapting a Goosebumps story, they created this sort of meta story where it was the creator of Goosebumps.
Yes.
And
all the books were coming to life. Yeah.
So what if in D&D they're basically doing a riff on the cartoon, a meta thing where it's people who are playing D&D and they go into the D&D world? And they do it as a comedy.
I wouldn't want to see it.
Me neither. And that's what I'm a little... Because that's of a piece with the Goosebumps approach.
It'd be weird if he did that, say, if he became the guy who does weird meta projects like that.
Yeah,
not... That's a scary thought, Randy. Why'd you bring it up?
Sorry. It's just been in my head.
Yeah. No, I could see it.
And it's also that's also a throwback to the D&D cartoon.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of Big Bang Theory-ish in that it would be kind of spoofing on geeks, but presumably doing it in a lovable way.
Yeah.
You know what? I've seen it done well in Galaxy Quest.
It could be done well, but it's not what I want.
Because they have yet to do... You know, Galaxy Quest was playing around with the very, pretty, you know, pretty successful Star Trek film series and TV show.
Yes.
TV shows. D&D has never had that, and so I want them to have a core good movie before they get wacky. But I don't mind there being a pretty good sense of humor, too.
Yeah, we want a sense of humor. We don't necessarily want wacky.
Right. I feel like the tone, roughly, that Guardians of the Galaxy had, which was, like, a lot of humor, could still work.
I agree. I think that's kind of what we're looking for. All right. Also in movie news, and speaking of properties that have never been done well... video games is another shot at finally getting their Iron Man, their video game movie.
Yes.
And that is the Assassin's Creed movie. And we saw the trailer, and I feel confident saying this is not going to be that movie.
I don't think it will. Although, you know what? I heard somebody talking about it in the store, and they were like, that trailer was badass.
Really?
Yeah. Now, you know, visually it like looked enough like the trailers, but I've seen trailers for Assassin's Creed games over the years, and I played a few of them. And... I think I probably like the video game trailers more than the movie trailers. It was okay. It looked all right. I heard that some people were a little bit nervous because they're going to spend apparently a lot of time in the present. And only, you know, there's going to be the flashbacks to him doing the assassination thing when he goes into that virtual sort of rig.
Sure.
But I think people were worried that it's like a lot of time's going to be spent in the present, which is like spending a lot of time with the humans in a Transformers movie.
Yeah.
You're like, you want to see him in assassin mode.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
It's Michael Fassbender, so, I mean...
Sure, Michael Fassbender's been in lots of good stuff and lots of bad stuff. He's a working actor. It's like Michael Caine.
I honestly forgot it was. He's the lead?
Yeah, he's the lead.
Okay. I mean, that's good. I expect he will be good.
Yeah.
I didn't see anything in that ad that indicated strong characters.
There was nothing in the ad that made me go, oh, wow, that's cool. I want to see this.
And the action more or less looked like of a piece with the with the games.
And there was the Kanye West.
Which is just a weird call.
It was a little odd.
I'm trying to think, did he have, like, in the flashbacks, did he have, like, a partner in the... Well, he goes back to the Inquisition era.
Yeah.
Is he working with a partner or something like that who was training him or working with him? I've already kind of forgotten because this was a few days ago.
I don't know.
And it didn't make a strong impression on me. But having somebody for him to bounce off of a little bit of, whether it's a mentor or a partner, I do think, if I didn't make that up... that it's a good idea. A lone silent killer, unless you're like Clint Eastwood, is not usually a good movie. Anyway.
All right. One last thing before we drop on the news. This is a weird one. Kevin Smith is doing a Buckaroo Banzai TV show.
That's definitely happening, right?
I'm not sure how definite it is.
Okay. It sounded like he was like bidding for the rights or whatever.
So I guess the pitch is, I didn't know you heard this, that the first season would be essentially adapting the movie.
Right.
And the second season would be Against the World Crime League, other words, the movie that the sequel never happened.
Right.
And that's a good way to do it. I have seen Buckaroo Banzai, if you count the half times I've watched it once, because I fell asleep twice trying to watch it.
It's one of the it's one of those cult movies that I've never fallen into. Nick, I think you said you like it, all right?
Yeah, I've seen it a couple of times. I mean, I don't think I've loved it, but obviously I like it.
You don't have a Hong Kong Cavaliers jacket?
I do not have a Hong Kong Cavaliers jacket.
By the way, several people have just thrown their phone across the room and are admitting that we didn't like this movie. I know it is beloved.
You tell them that you like Hudson Hawk and everything will be all right.
I do like Hudson Hawk.
I love Hudson Hawk.
I have to confess, I did not see all of... I've never seen all of Buckaroo Banzai as a kid. I knew... It was one of those ones that seemed like it was pre-made as a cult movie.
Yeah.
I knew full well it was
yeah.
going to be a cult
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I think that didn't sit well with me as a kid, but I can't say I've actually ever seen the whole thing. So maybe I'll rewatch it one of these
days. Also have not seen the whole thing because, as mentioned, I've fallen asleep twice trying to watch it.
Randy, do you have trouble falling asleep?
No.
I was going to say, if not, we've got the cure. Kevin Smith seems both like a potentially good choice for this and potentially a terrible choice.
Yeah.
He apparently had a lot of fun directing his Flash episode.
Yeah.
And that seemed to, like, I guess, go over well with him. I heard varying things from people on it.
I had a few Kevin Smithisms in there, but overall it was a good episode.
The episode was here or there for me, but none of the problems I have with it were Kevin Smith related.
I heard he wants to play some character, and I don't know if that was
that's
him
not
just
a good
joking
idea.
Or not, but I did think that, yeah, unless Jay of Jay and Silent Bob makes his way into the Buckaroo Banzai universe, I generally don't want him on the screen.
Silent Bob cannot be a Hong Kong Cavalier. I'm sorry, Kevin Smith.
No.
He cannot.
They've really lowered their standards.
All right. We'll be back in just a few seconds to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, May 18th. And just to real quick reinforce, next week, when we're talking comics, we'll be doing it just before our midnight release.
Yes.
So midnight release next week for comics. Okay. Or at least for Marvel and DC comics.
Yep.
Okay. So let's talk about this week. And I'm going to start us off. This was a really good week for me. I liked pretty much every book I read. I thought it was going to be a lighter week, but there was a lot of books I really liked and some stuff I didn't get a chance to read yet. But I want to start with my pick, which is Beauty Number 7. This is an Image book that I really liked the first story arc of, and it had this great premise of a venereal disease that basically made you beautiful.
And it's not often that comics have a great premise that involves venereal disease, but legitimately this was a clever idea.
Yeah, and it felt Vertigo-esque. I mean, it's an Image book, but it felt Vertigo-esque, and like a lot of theirs do. And it was about sort of beauty standards in the world, sex, power, money, all that kind of stuff. And
yeah. And wrapped up in sort of like a mystery and an investigation.
Yeah, and sort of...
Like where it came from and what, you know, if there was, when people got it,
if they were going to die.
If they were going to die.
There was a question of, like, are people burning alive after having the beauty for a while?
Yeah.
Well, the Beauty Number 7 jumps back to before that story took place and sort of sets up what the ongoing series is going to be like, which is that basically it's almost more like something like 100 Bullets or, you know, one of those things where we're seeing stories from that world or what Lazarus occasionally does where he'll jump and tell us stories of a different part of the world. So... This takes us into the story of a right after the beauty had been revealed, people were starting to learn what it was, that it's this disease that makes people beautiful, perfect-looking people. And it focuses on this big this gangster who's this big, giant guy. His boss is...
He's highly placed, or do you mean he's literally huge?
He's a big, giant guy.
Okay.
Yes, he's huge. He's like 300 pounds.
Yep.
He's talking about the guy who runs his crew, that he's the sloppy, worthless son of the boss, always got us damn near killed, and that when he got the beauty came along and his boss got it. And not spoiling anything to say that in the first four pages, basically our lead character goes on a rampage and kills his entire crew, including the son of the boss.
Uh-huh.
And then he's like, well... There's when you do this kind of thing, there's no way to vanish. There's no way to you can't just move. So in order to get away from it, he takes the beauty and becomes a different person. So it's basically the beauty.
I presume that you're just like having unprotected sex.
No, it's actually pills.
Oh, okay.
It's actually pills. But yeah, it's really interesting. It's very much a crime story about doing something bad and getting away from it, which we've seen that kind of story before. But to incorporate the element of the beauty is really interesting. And
it's like a witness protection program in a pill.
Yeah. And it also has a guest artist named Mike Huddleston, who I really like. And importantly, this is a one-shot story. Because the next few issues, they're going to bring in artist Brett Weldell, and he's going to do another sort of story in the world of the beauty.
And you were saying, if you haven't read it...
If you haven't read it, this really doesn't get into the overarching story of who caused it, why, what's the cure about, all that kind of stuff. This is basically a what would it be like to live in this world kind of anthology story.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I really, really dug it. I thought it was a good standalone crime story. So definitely worth a read.
Very approachable.
Dave, what you got?
All right, I have the book that I've been excited for like the last, well, since it was announced.
Yes.
And that is from DC Comics, Future Quest number 1.
Yes.
This spearheads their Hanna-Barbera line, which will next week for our midnight release, we'll have the Scooby Apocalypse one. Yep. Also looking forward to it. But this is their, like, the one that has their Adventure Heroes line headlined by Johnny Quest, it will also incorporate Space Ghost, the Herculoids, Birdman, some other lesser known ones.
Yes.
Now, the interesting thing about this for me is, like, I when I was a kid, I was catching reruns of, like, I guess probably, like, the 60s adventure shows with Johnny Quest and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally, a few relaunches. I'm not, like, a devotee of it.
I actually outright dislike most of Hanna-Barbera stuff.
Now, the adventure stuff, though, it was serious adventure at a time when there wasn't a lot of that.
Yeah. Oh, the Johnny Quest opening sequence, I love.
Yeah. But, like, Johnny Quest, the show itself was pretty good.
I just never watched it.
I mean, this was, like, until, like, anime came along, this is the only place where bad guys got blown up and died.
Sure.
And stuff.
Yeah.
And I was very happy to find, though, that what I did like about the stuff that I had seen was all on display in this. It was as good as I had hoped it might be.
Yeah, this book is so damn good.
This probably
could have been the pick for me and Nick as well.
Yeah. I think we all really liked it. Sort of at its heart is a mystery involving sort of portals that are opening up in the world, these kind of vortexes that are being investigated by Dr. Quest. And he's brought in some, like, are they brought in as specialists?
Yeah, they're from, what is it?
There's an agency that they're with.
Called Falcon 7.
Yeah, Falcon 7, and that is Birdman, which is not the coolest name in the world, but he's cool.
He's cool.
And in fact, as depicted, you know what? There's an interesting vibe to this, Randy. You know how, like, to bring up Darwin Cook, you know how cool he made the Cold War era heroes look in New Frontier?
Yeah.
Birdman and the girl who is with him, I don't know if that's an original character.
I don't know who she is
or
either.
Not, but one of the other agents, they have that kind of mod 60s look. They look super cool. And so before he ever, like, you know, superheroes up, he looks cool, and there is a kind of a cool tone to the whole series.
And they also open with a Green Lantern-ish Space Ghost thing.
Yes.
That is sort of the... I was wondering how you're going to incorporate, say, Space Ghost and the Herculoids into Johnny Quest.
Right, because they're like futuristic sci-fi.
And the way they do it is so clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a very clever thing that kind of brings these worlds together and sort of also just acknowledges that, yes, in the Quest universe... Birdman is a character that I think when he does make his appearance, he says something like, I thought he was a legend, so that it's not like, and then somebody's like, oh, he is, you know.
But
it's very cool. The action is good. Johnny Quest and Haji also
so much fun.
And Race all get cool scenes. It is old school classic adventure comics, but and also incorporating a little bit of that League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, let's let these characters meet.
You know, it's funny, you say old school, and I always think of some of the old school stuff is boring.
Yeah, that's true.
And I didn't get an old school vibe from this. I mean, it's classic.
Right.
But it's, this. I think you nailed it, like, this is New Frontier for the Hanna-Barbera characters.
Yeah,
it is taking what is cool about them, making a modern version that also acknowledges what was cool about them in the past. Like, there's lots of visual homages to stuff that's in the Johnny Quest cartoon.
Yep, even if you only know it on a cursory basis, like we kind of do, you'll see stuff, you're like, oh, I know what that is, or I remember seeing that in the opening and stuff. And a lot of the credit must go to Evan Shaner.
Yeah.
And I do note that Steve Rude drew a few pages of it.
Steve Rude draws the flashback with the bad guys, I think, for the most part.
No, he drew the last few pages, so the stuff where there's some glimpses of Herculoid stuff.
Okay.
That's him right there.
Okay, yeah.
Um, Anyway, there's also a few original characters in here. What's interesting is that with all those things, it could have gotten convoluted.
Yeah, but it doesn't.
Because it's all sort of lens through the eyes, either of Johnny or his dad.
Yep.
It's actually pretty all, it's all kept together, and I'm loving it.
I'll actually be surprised if this doesn't wind up on my top 10 for the year. Yeah. I was very, very taken with it.
The team was the one that I was most excited about for the Hanna-Barbera line. I mean, Jeff Parker and Evan Shaner was kind of a no-brainer for me. I loved. Did they do the convergence that had Captain Marvel and Gotham by Gaslight?
Yes,
I know Shaner did. I just couldn't remember if Parker wrote it.
And yeah.
I was surprised at how much I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And so I'd been looking forward to it, and it lived up to expectations.
Yeah, it's really good. We all think you should buy it.
It's very true.
Nick, what's your pick?
Nicholas?
My pick is Marvel's Big Event book has started, sort of. It's a zero issue. It is Civil War II.
Yep.
This
is a Bendis book, right?
This is a Bendis book.
You know what?
Yeah.
I liked it.
it's a little hard to believe, but...
Everybody out there, make a backup copy as you're listening to this. So when Randy runs for president, you've got proper blackmail material.
No, the cruel thing is, Nick is going to give me his digital copy of Deadpool this week.
Yeah.
So if I wind up liking that, which I'm honestly expecting I will, this will be a week in which I like to Bendis comic and Deadpool.
You sicken me, Randy.
I know. I sicken myself.
Well, the cool thing about this zero issue, it's actually just a series of vignettes focusing on different characters. One focusing on Captain Marvel, one focusing on War Machine, She-Hulk and the Inhumans.
Yep.
You know what that reminds me of? With another book we all liked, and I haven't read this yet, but I know y'all really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other week when they did that Doctor Strange thing that had all the
Last magic, Days of Magic, yeah.
Magic,
yeah.
And, like, every one of those little vignettes was really satisfying. I don't always necessarily like that format, but, like, when it's done right, it's awesome.
Well, yeah, and especially, I don't always like when Bendis does the talky stuff. But I thought he was really good here.
Yeah, I felt like the character moments here and the story beats that he was aiming at were very effective. She-Hulk.
She-Hulk's legal speech.
Yeah, a legal speech and sort of defending a villain for something kind of, minor.
It was a good courtroom scene.
Yeah, it's a great courtroom scene. I loved the scene with Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
Sort of talking to Doc Samson.
Yeah, that was great.
Mainly because I like Doc Samson. I've always liked
his psychological... What's he doing these days?
He's spending time as a superhero and a psychologist, because that's Doc Samson.
Yeah, I love Doc Samson when he's done well.
And there's a cool new thing. There's a cool thing with Rhodey, which I thought was a lot of fun.
There's a weird turn in there that I'm like, I'd never considered that before.
No, but I actually thought the ideas that Bendis brings up with that, with the sort of stuff with,
I didn't feel like it fits. I didn't feel like it fits his character at all. But it's interesting.
It's interesting. Whether or not it fits completely.
And then his take on the Terrigen Mist thing was interesting. I'd never seen it in that way.
It reminded me a little bit of the people, like, waiting for the aliens in Independence Day.
Yeah, hopefully it goes as well as that did.
Yeah. But the... And I have to...
People are out, come to be mists.
Of, yeah, the mist is coming across the Ohio State campus. And they're like, the Terrigen's coming. Yeah. I wonder if any of us will get powers.
People are all like, oh my god, I wonder what's going to happen.
I can imagine that being a very exciting moment and something where even if you were scared of it, you might be like, I'm going out in the mist.
Yep.
Yeah, and there's just some cool stuff. And honestly, the art by
the art is so good.
Olivier Coppel.
Yeah.
This is some strong work. I know these guys worked together when they did House of M, but I think he's even progressed further as an artist.
Yeah.
And
he is a for real great artist.
Yeah, the art in this is really, really good.
I have a layman's question.
Yep.
Does it establish whatever the central dilemma is for that Civil War will be about or something?
No.
Not really. I mean,
no, for that you need the Free Comic Book Day issue that comes after this, which is kind of weird.
So it's set after
the Free Comic Book Day definitely comes after this issue.
It does.
But if you buy Civil War number zero while supplies last, and they should, you will get a free copy of the Free Comic Book Day issue if you don't already have it.
That's awesome.
And that sort of sets up the what the crux of the Civil War II is going to be about.
I mean, there are some big moments, and there are some things revealed in this issue that will definitely carry through the series.
I couldn't escape the feeling that we were reading this, and it was basically a look at all these cool characters before bad things happen to them.
It's very much calm before the storm type stuff, but it's a very satisfying read.
So I'm still not sure I'm going to like Civil War II overall, but as the prologue is pretty good.
It's, Marvel has had a decent track record with events and then the last couple years with, Secret Wars ended up being pretty satisfying.
Yeah.
So, It's possible.
Nick, what about your backup pick?
My backup pick is another Marvel book. It is the 9th issue of the book Uncanny Avengers.
You've been liking this book a lot.
I have. It's a few times. Lot of fun. It's the Unity team, so, you know, Steve Rogers, Deadpool, Brother Voodoo, Quicksilver, Human Torch. You know, this is
and
weird.
Rogue. And never Rogue. Forget Rogue.
And it's a weird array of characters.
Sugar.
I think the big thing about this is that this story arc, which is a new one, called The Man Who Fell to Earth, is harking back to the Rage of Ultron original graphic novel that they Marvel put out a while back, where sort of Hank Pym has merged with Ultron. Basically, to save the Earth, he, like, stops Ultron, but he, like, has to merge with him. It was a weird story, but overall, some of the outcome of that is dealt with here as Hank decides to come back to Earth.
Sure, why not?
Artist?
This artist is...
Looks pretty good.
Yeah, it's beautiful art. Not 100% sure. His last name is... Laraz.
Okay.
We don't know him.
But it looks good.
Yeah, it's very sort of it's just fun and animated, and there's some great action pieces where Deadpool and Captain America are on like a wildlife preserve that they're getting people out of like animal activists. It's a little weird, but there's just some fun stuff with Rogue having to deal with Gambit. He shows up again. There's just some fun character bits in here, and I think that's what kind of pushes the story forth and gets me interested. And Jerry Dugan's version of Hank Pym is interesting.
Okay.
Not what I was expecting.
Dave, your backup pick?
My backup pick is a series I've never picked before.
Nope.
Astro City.
Right. Except for every issue before this.
Is it actually issue 35?
35.
No, wait, is that since the relaunch?
Since the relaunch.
Okay. Really? Yeah. 35 issues?
Yeah, it's been going strong.
That is as consecutive as he's ever done.
Yeah.
You've picked about 30.
Yeah, that's about right. So this issue zeroes in on one of the earliest Astro Cities that were revealed way back in the day.
Issue 3, I believe, right?
Yeah, Jack in the Box. A clown-themed kind of swashbuckling crime fighter with kind of party, you know, like confetti, you know... you know, flashbangs and stuff like that. He always used kind of clown stuff to fight crime.
But he has, like, extendo arms and
things. Yeah.
He's sort of their Spider-Man Daredevil.
Yep. And we've seen little bits and pieces, I think, of his behind the scenes, but not much, right? Have we seen, like, his backstory?
Yeah, we can remember the issue where they revealed about him, his wife having a kid.
Yep.
That was issue seven, I think, of the original series.
Yep.
And it was a great story, and it was sort of about...
You know, it's been a long time since I read that.
He was visited by, like,
the ghost of the future, yeah. If it was issue seven,
we're talking, like, 20 years
ago. Yeah, it was sort of a, what can you be a dad and still be a superhero? And I think he essentially decided to retire.
Right.
And so, since Astro City moves in real time...
Yes, we have moved on to his son, right?
Yeah.
Which I believe we will... And this is his story of his sort of family lineage of the shared superhero ancestry.
His son's like 17 now, I think.
Yeah. And his grandfather was also Jack in the Box.
Yes.
There have been like now three of them.
Yeah.
And what I thought was interesting is we've certainly... Marvel and DC, this is a play on sort of the family lineage thing. That
sure.
We've seen characters pass down the mantle and stuff in Marvel and DC, especially DC, I guess.
Yeah.
But honestly, it is unique to do it with a black family.
Yeah.
And there is something... There's more going on here than that. First of all, it's just interesting to see how it works.
Yeah.
But they also even... There's like sort of a group of like sort of... enthusiasts, I guess groupies almost surrounding him, that they ended up training.
Well, they're his Baker Street irregulars. They're his...
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
And there's sort of this sense of entrepreneurship and black community building within it as the backstory.
Yeah.
That's very, like, kind of a cool positive thing where you see him growing up with these people that, like, they train him.
Yeah.
Like, the new one is training with what had been, like, the sort of... It'd be like being trained by the Baker Street Irregulars to the job. And there's a question of, like, well, how serious should he get into the superhero thing? And when he's a kid, he doesn't know. It's like, oh, if my dad was this superhero, my grandfather was a superhero, do I have to become this superhero?
Yeah.
You know, and also, why did my dad retire? This seems like the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah.
You know, why would you ever retire?
Yeah.
So it's also about, you know, a kid kind of running into a bit of the real world questions, you know, the dangers of it.
And then it also delves into sort of Jack in the Box's villains. You know,
yep.
Busick is so good at coming up with villains for this run. Yep. Like, I love that his sort of Kingpin-esque type guy.
Yeah, yeah.
The sort of weird genetic hybrid type thing, robot things that are his foes.
It's, those spoke to almost. They seemed like the what is it? The original Blue Beetle, I think. I remember in the
The,
what do they call those madmen,
yeah.
They seem like a bit of a riff on that, don't you think?
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, that's his crime boss is the Underlord.
Yeah.
Is a cool character. What I always like is that there's a sense that he is visiting all these themes that Marvel and DC have talked about,
yeah.
But he's developing them in ways that they can't because they tend to just be adventure comics.
Agreed. No one should get the impression that Astro City is like Marvel or DC with the serial numbers filed off.
Exactly.
This is a guy who loved both universes and has incorporated all this and created his own unique original universe,
yeah.
with ties thematically back to it,
yeah.
But at no point are you be like, oh, that's Spider-Man versus Kingpin. No, it's not that.
Right. Well, what this is about more than anything else is lineage and also, I would say, like, community.
Yeah.
And also that sense of living up to, like, family expectations.
Yeah.
Where you know, so there's these broader themes that give it a richness.
Yeah.
That is what Astro City is about. So anyway, another really good, not standalone story, another good Astro City story, but it is the first part of what will be a multi-parter.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really good. My backup story is another book that we've never mentioned before, All New Wolverine number 8. I believe last time this might have been my pick. It was the single issue with Squirrel Girl.
It was weird that you picked number 8, somehow not having read it yet.
This does continue from Squirrel Girl. They now have a pet Wolverine.
Yes.
Which is funny.
Which yet Squirrel Girl had brought previously.
Yep. This has a lot of that. Tom Taylor's writing this, and he's the guy who writes Injustice, and he's always done good dialogue and humor and that kind of thing. So this book is sort of the perfect blend of action and humor. It reminds me of what I like in a good, like, 80s action comedy type thing, because the sort of buddy relationship between Laura and her young clone Gabby reminds me of what I liked about Molly in Runaways, and that's always fun, and she's sort of, you know, trying to bring her into the world, and there's a running gag about Chinese food, and that Gabby's never had it. And then it brings in S.H.I.E.L.D. in a really interesting way, because S.H.I.E.L.D. needs help, and they call in Wolverine, who's sort of a reluctant hero. She doesn't want to be involved in all this stuff, but she keeps getting called in. And there's a reason they call her in specifically, and there's a big reveal as to who the bad guy is, which I loved. And an even bigger reveal about why they need Wolverine and what she's going to be up to the next issue, which I don't know that we've seen that story done except in maybe the Bible. trying not to spoil anything.
What on earth?
Nick knows exactly what I mean, though, because he's read it, too.
You know, Tom Taylor, we talked about this, because he did Injustice for their digital thing originally,
yeah.
And he did these 8-page story segments, he's become very good at, like, you know, what do you call it? Geez, I can't say. I'm at a loss for words. But story structure is essentially what I was going to say. And so you're talking about sort of some notable reveals and stuff.
Yeah.
Something he's particularly talented at.
There's also fantastic artwork by Marcio Takara.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really... I would have been disappointed because David Lopez did this book originally, and I really love David Lopez's art. And I thought I'd be disappointed with whoever came on next, but, man, he just kills it in here. There's a shot of a certain Marvel landmark that blew me away.
Yeah.
So, very, very good stuff. Action comedy at its best.
I really think Taylor's building Laura up into being a really good character.
Yes, agreed. I was never a huge X-23 fan, but now I kind of like it.
Well, in a lot of ways, she was just kind of feral Wolverine and, you know...
She had a particularly dark backstory.
Yeah. And this is another side of her, and we're seeing a little bit more, you know, depth. And
yeah, the darkness is still there, but they've lightened her up a little bit and made her a more approachable character.
Yeah, I have a feeling some people might... I mean, I know there are some people who avoid it because they're like, oh, it's Girl Wolverine, but... and they say it like that.
Do they?
They do. But I also think some people who I think would really like the book might have skipped it just because it's like... It feels like a book that maybe has, like, too much history behind it, or you're like, you just don't want to read a Wolverine book, even if it's not actually Logan as Wolverine.
Yeah.
Like, but this feels in a way like, it's almost like a great new superhero.
Yeah,
you know,
it
just
is.
Just a new character that you can get on board here and, you know, have been on and on the ground floor of a really strong new character.
Yeah. No, I really dig it. All right. Also on my list this week is a fair amount of stuff. Rye number 13, which I know sounds weird since we've never talked about Rye the 1 through 12. But this is basically a jumping on point because it's tied into the 4001 AD crossover they've been doing. And it is a story of New Japan and 4001 AD takes place in 4001 AD. This story takes place in 3001 Japan when the first Rai is created. And Japan, the New Japan that is sort of the space station, is trying to become something more suitable for its people. It's a really interesting story. It makes me want to go back and read more of the Rai stuff.
Look at that cover. That's a cool minimalist cover.
That is a really nice cover, and it is by David Mack, actually.
Oh, okay. Oh, that makes sense. That makes sense.
So this was really good, and if you've been reading the 4001 AD stuff, or if you have any interest in sort of futuristic superheroes, definitely give that one a look, even if you've read no other Valiant stuff. May number one is Gene Haas, sort of written. He created it, he writes and draws. It's a story of a young girl who was off in a Oz-like world and now comes back to ours, and the monsters have followed her back. Ant-Man number eight, which is another great issue of Ant-Man. This is sort of a standalone focusing on several forgettable villains, including, I think, solo Avengers character The Voice.
Uh-huh.
And Hijacker, a guy who can supercharge whatever vehicle he gets in. It is a tribute to D-list villains.
Okay.
Spider-Woman number seven is the penultimate chapter of the Spider-Women crossover. It features Jessica going up against her doppelganger from another world. It's great. It's everything Spider-Woman always is. Power Man and Iron Fist number four finishes that story arc. I love a good four-issue initial story arc. I thought it was a really good finale, and has that.
Is going to be a small trade?
No, they'll probably do five and six in it as well.
Okay.
But it's got beautiful art by Sanford Green, the usual real fun writing by David Walker. Jughead number six, I believe, wraps up the Chip Zdarsky and Erica Henderson run on the book. Goldie Vance number two is the next issue of Hope Larson's...
Oh, I forgot to grab that.
Sort of high school detective book.
Yeah, yeah.
I really liked.
I really liked the first one.
And then there's Apocrypha Now, which is the next volume in the God Is Disappointed in You. Is that right? Shannon Wheeler basically went through the Bible and sort of makes goofy references throughout.
Oh, is that Shannon Wheeler?
It's Shannon Wheeler from Too Much Coffee Man.
I didn't know that.
And then this goes through a biblical apocrypha and does the same thing where it sort of snarks at the Bible. So that's either going to be completely up your alley or not even remotely up your alley. Flash by Jeff Johns, Volume 2. This is when Scott Collins really came on board and became the regular artist. Features the Weather Wizard, some of the new rogues, I believe Captain Cold. And this is really where that run gets started. This is a favorite Flash run of all of us.
Yeah.
Howard the Duck, Volume 1, which is both a really good read, and also Joe Quinones, who is the artist, is going to be here for our All Ages Awesomeness event in June. Silk Volume 1, which is a continuation of... This is the post-Secret Wars relaunch of Silk, where she's working with Black Cat undercover for S.H.I.E.L.D. Really digging that. A weird one, Avengers K, Avengers vs. Ultron, which is the Korean Avengers.
Yep. And it's like based on like... Isn't this like on sort of more classic Avengers story?
Yeah, it's the Ant-Man Vision. I mean, Vision's in there, but...
Sort of a retelling of those...
Early days.
Yeah.
Although I see Beast, Wonder Man...
But that's like 70s era Avengers. It's, I think, like, visually it looks a little updated.
It's full color. It's got a definite manga style to it and looks really interesting. I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
I forgot that was this week too. I wanted to read that.
And then, although this probably won't be on the shelf because Nick is too good at selling things before they even hit the shelf, the Lazarus second hardcover is available. We love this book and the hardcovers are spectacular, so definitely worth a look. Dave, what did I miss?
Let's see. There's a really good standalone issue of Usagi Yojimbo, issue 154. One of those ones where if you were to just randomly want to pick up an issue, this is a good one. It has a ninja bat in it.
Sure.
Let's see. Did you mention Sabrina?
I did not.
Sabrina gets its fifth issue. That's the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, the very, very dark period piece story that... I've really been enjoying, but due to rather extreme delays, I'm a little bit lost as to exactly what's going on. But I'm still looking forward to reading this because the previous issues were so good.
Yeah.
Let's see. Micronauts gets its second issue from IDW. I've not read that yet, but the first issue was a very fun sort of sci-fi Firefly-esque comic. And yep. So looking forward to that. Let's see. Superman American Alien wraps up Max Landis's surprisingly approachable run and... kind of novel vision of Superman and Clark Kent to make him a... He came across as more personable... in this than I've seen him in a long time. And then there's William Gibson's thing. Did we mention this?
Nope.
So William Gibson, who you might remember from creating all cyberpunk of all time.
Yep.
Or from Neuromancer or...
And Neuromancer was his novel that sort of created. Snow Crash is not him.
It's not him. Whatever. It's
all Neuromancer, Mona Lisa Overdrive, Virtual Light.
Yeah. Mars Party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the father of cyberpunk.
He is the father of cyberpunk and an extremely notable science fiction author. Is doing a new series for IDW... which I'm trying to remember what the premise was for.
It is sort of it's a military science fiction military operation. Basically, like looks like sort of a post-apocalyptic version of 2016, like an alternate timeline.
Yeah,
and they send them back to 1945 to try and realign the timeline.
Right,
and there's sort of competing agendas going on. There's like a British intelligence agent who's working with an American soldier. And there's this futuristic team that's back trying to fix things and another futuristic team working against them. If you've read William Gibson, you know he tends to do sort of multi-layered, crazy alternate world stories.
Yes.
And this is definitely one of those.
Always with kind of an edge.
I forget, he's also, along with Bruce Sterling, I believe that they created the Difference Engine, which I believe was the beginning of steampunk.
Yeah.
So he's created two genres.
Yep. I believe cosplayers everywhere should thank this man. It also has art, by the way, by Butch Geist,
yep.
Really notable artist who, among other things, drew Captain America for some of the stuff when Brubaker was writing it.
Yep.
Way back in the day, he drew Micronauts. He's a great artist.
Yep.
So check it out.
Nick, what did we miss?
I only have two things left. So okay. I've got Deadpool Last Days of Magic number one, which...
I'm surprised one of us didn't mention.
Yeah, why did we not mention Deadpool?
I don't know. Now that you've seen the movies...
no, but it deals with sort of what the Empirical are having to do with Deadpool's wife, since she's sort of a demon and magic. And some of the sort of lesser of the Marvel kind of... There's Frankenstein, a few of their monsters and things that show up. And Deadpool kind of tries to save everyone. And then there's a new series of Tank Girl, which I randomly decided to read, and it was bonkers and crazy.
Yep.
Which is exactly what you want with Tank Girl.
Yep. The art looked nice when I was flipping through.
Gorgeous.
Who is it?
It is Brett Parson.
Oh, I don't know that artist.
I don't know, but it's really fun, very animated. It's about as bonkers as any Tank Girl story I've ever read.
All right. All right, that wraps up our comic talk for the week. We're going to be back in just a few seconds to talk about a variety of topics we've been putting off. Yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Podcasts, board games, video games, TV, all things. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Okay. The last few weeks we've been doing previews, review, and other stuff, so we haven't had a chance to get to topics. So we've got a lot of stuff to talk about this time.
Yep. Each one will get 5 seconds.
And go. No, we're going to talk about... We're going to start with podcasts. Nick, of course, is the podcast addict.
I am an addict.
And he keeps putting us onto other stuff. And then I believe Dave discovered one that he's got Nick into.
Yep.
But let's start...
Nick had forgotten, but Nick had mentioned to me, at least when he had heard about it.
Oh, okay. So let's start with one we've all been listening to, and that is The Bright Sessions.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this was pointed to me. I went on the Pacific Northwest Stories Reddit.
Oh, okay.
The guys who do the Black Tapes and Tannis.
And they have actually a really good Reddit where they actually keep people, they are involved in it as well.
Posting in character.
Huh. And also just a good group of people on there, and a lot of things come up, and one of the topics was what other podcasts do you listen to? And I found like a whole list of them there, so I've been kind of delving into that, and that's where I found The Bright Sessions.
Yeah.
Which has become an obsession because I flew through the entire
thing. So you're caught up all 19 episodes.
Yes.
And Dave, you are...
I'm about where I was the other day, which is like episode 7 or 8. They're shorter episodes.
Yeah,
so it's easy
I do like the short 15 to 20 minutes,
yeah,
baby.
Yeah, between 15
let's,
and 20.
Let's stay with the basic
and I'm is. And I'm on episode 9, just before where we are.
Basically, if you want the short pitch, it's X-Men meets Entreatment.
Yeah.
Because it's basically people...
Meets
with
what?
Entreatment.
It was HBO series. But it's basically people with unique abilities... seeking out some help through a psychologist who put out a ad in
like a
newspaper.
Classified ad, Yeah, it's so, sort of, it'd be sort of like if you imagine yourself getting sort of growing to have telepathic powers or something like that. It's not a world. It's like the real world. So yeah. Powers are not known.
Right. When I first thought, I was like, this is like powers where superheroes come in for help. No. This is like Dr. Bright is a psychiatrist who seems to have some kind of her own agenda.
Yes.
And she is trying to help these kids, teenagers usually, who are – or 20-somethings who have unusual powers. She seems to know about them, so she's not freaked out when they get – when they have them. She's – that's what she was looking for. So far at episode 9, there are three characters. It sort of jumps between them, and there's two women and one man.
Mm-hmm.
And then episode 10 adds another guy.
Correct.
And basically, they jump. Each episode is about one of them, and Sarah jumps back and forth as they're going through their lives, and it's their session. So she talks to them, she asks them questions, she asks them about their powers, about their lives, and I don't think it's too much to give away that it's like the powers are all sort of psychic in nature for the most part.
Yeah, one is a telepath.
Yeah, one's an empath.
One's an empath,
and one is a time traveler of sorts.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about this for me. Aside from this, you know, essentially these are dialogue driven. This is a dialogue driven podcast. You are hearing Dr. Bright interviewing these people. And over the course of like roughly half an hour, a story emerges as she kind of asks what they've been up to and talks with them about their powers. And they actually have a pretty strong story arc for a little half hour episode.
Yeah.
But they think about these powers in ways I thought were really neat. And I would like, even though I don't want X-Men to become like a talky book, I always thought, it'd be interesting. Usually when people, have psychic powers in the X-Men, the only problem they have is, too many minds around me at once, running out of control. And this gets a little bit more into kind of some of the nuances of how that might push you, how you might think about things differently if you had those powers.
Yeah, some of the descriptions of what telepathy – she's trying to convey what telepathy feels like, and it's really interesting. It's like someone describing a sense you don't have.
Yeah, or there's the kid who's like, he's kind of like a jock kid.
Yeah,
he's the empath.
Yeah.
So this is just an interesting concept in and of itself. You take a guy who doesn't have a ton of sympathy for like kind of the losers as he perceives them.
He's a football guy.
He's not a bad guy, but he's just a little. He was not a guy who would typically be high on the empathy scale.
Yeah,
right.
And but he has this power where he's feeling everybody's feelings all the time, and they come up with some really interesting ways for him to lens it. Sometimes he'll talk about like overlapping emotions and how one is like one color and one is like the other, and it's sort of the like a yellow emotion and a green or yellow blue emotion will combine to form a green emotion. Mm-hmm. And there's some really neat concepts in there. Honestly,
it's really good. I really like this,
and I will say there is a larger story.
Yes.
Yeah, I can tell that just from listening so far,
and it does progress pretty quickly. But
is it the season ended, Nick?
No.
Okay.
It's still coming out. I don't know. I think every 2 weeks, somewhere.
I don't know.
Pretty prolific.
And then there's Hello from the Magic Tavern.
Oh, yeah. this is a – I don't do a lot of sort of a comedy podcast, but this is one that our coworker Amanda mentioned to me. She had not yet listened to it, but she said she was meaning to, and I like fantasy-type stuff, so I checked it out.
Yep.
The premise is fun on this. a guy has fallen through a magical portal behind a Burger King.
In New Jersey?
I think so.
Yeah.
And ended up in a sort of magical Narnia-esque world.
Yeah, but he had his podcast equipment with him.
He had his, laptop and stuff, and he's still getting a loose signal from our world.
He's getting a little bit of Wi-Fi from Burger King.
From Burger King in fantasy world, though. And he is going to each week interview patrons of the magic of this tavern, the Vermilion Minotaur.
Yeah, I think that's right. Vermilion Minotaur sounds right.
It's essentially an excuse for maybe a 20-30 minute podcast for sort of some improv actors in the role of wizards, a shape changed badger.
Yep.
Various other guests. Later, a sentient flower who's an obnoxious sort of drunk. The flower is actually hilariously foul-mouthed. And I should say, I wasn't sure as of the first episode if this was a... I was like, well, that's like PG-13. Okay, it's R in later episodes. It's for sure R. The way that the guy gets shape changes in the first is revealed in the first episode and has to do with sex. It is sort of a raunchy improv show, and I found myself really enjoying it. I went through probably I'm gonna say 5 or 6 episodes so far. It's There's been a few kind of ones that I thought were a little bit misfires. Usually when whoever the guests they have are a little bit just don't quite live up to improv. You know, it's sometimes that's how improv goes.
Right.
But for the most part, I really like it. I love the wizard who is one of the central characters. He's in every episode so far. Kind of can't say his name, but now, Randy, you tried it and you were like, meh.
I heard the first episode. It's okay. I'm just not sure I want to invest in it. So I'm already listening to West Wing Weekly and Bright Sessions and trying to keep up with all the stuff I have.
But I would in general, if you're looking for a comedic podcast and the premise sounds at all interesting, I would say to give it a shot. It is a dialogue-driven thing that sort of has, to me, it's kind of the same snarkiness of like an Archer or something like that.
Yeah.
Poking at fantasy traditions and stuff, but also weird Prince references. There is a now kind of particularly weird one where they go off like on an extreme Prince reference series of references in like the second or third episode. It was before he died.
Yeah.
But it's just like that was weird now.
And then another one that Nick recommended to you and probably forgot. The Magnus Chronicles?
Or Magnus Archives.
Magnus Archives.
Yeah. That one I'm about three episodes in and really enjoying. This is another one for you scary podcast people. You've got a British host who is presents himself as the archivist for a university that I think sort of has like a supernatural sort of wing, of their library. It feels like it's not just part of their library, but they actually have had for like 200 years a portion of the university devoted to investigating occult stuff.
Okay,
and they have an extremely unkempt archive that is like poorly ordered, and he is going through those trying to clean things up for them. He's the new guy after some incident with the previous one. It's essentially each episode though is him reading somebody's account. You know what you would imagine if you after the fact interviewed somebody about The Exorcist or something like that. How they might have done it. So it's always in his voice. There's no other voice actors in it. But the stories are creepy. They're an unnerving brand of horror. I'm trying to remember the first one. I'm gonna mention the second one. The second one is a guy who's like describes himself as having gone like sort of partying in Amsterdam with some college friends, and while he was high one night, he makes a deal. A guy offers him like 10,000. What's their currency over there? Francs, Deutschmarks, whatever it is. Offers him that to hold a package for him, and he's like, I would have ignored it any other time, but seeing the money in front of me and being high, I did it. And then he suddenly immediately regrets it, and like afterward, the guy is like, okay, I'll be back in touch. The guy never gets back in touch. He goes back home. He's like working on his like graduate degree, and he gets a package one day, which is a coffin that has been shipped to him. And the description of it is really weird. He says it's like it comes with, it's like locked, it's got a key, but there's like a scratched into it, it says not to open it or something like that.
Okay.
It's warm to the touch, and what happens is he's afraid to get rid of it. He's also terrified of getting the law involved. Because he does have the money and he spent a little bit of it at this point. And what follows is a very strange series of incidents as he keeps it in his apartment and tries to live with it. When it rains, he hears scratchings inside of it. It's a subtle kind of horror, but not so subtle that it's not like pretty creepy right from the out of the gates. The story does come to a resolution, or at least this guy's role in it does. And they're all like that in that each one of them touches on, you know, some strange thing like that. I'd say the creep factor is pretty high on this one. I'm recommending it pretty strongly.
Okay.
What else we got?
All right. Nick, you've been listening to Wolf 359.
Yeah. Wolf 359.
Which is not a Star Trek podcast.
It is not a Star Trek podcast.
By the way, is that the actual episode or the
Wolf 359 is where the Borg attacks the Federation.
It actually was that. Okay. Yeah. I just wasn't sure if I was thinking
nope,
that.
That's
or
correct.
Not.
That's correct.
Yes. But it is not a Star Trek podcast. It is basically the life and times of three individuals who are on a USS space station called the Hephaestus.
Okay.
And mainly focusing on one guy, his name, he's like the communications officer, and his desire to just be the ultimate slacker. So it's got a little bit of, like, Last Man on Earth.
Red Dwarf.
Red Dwarf, a few other things. And it really started out being very funny, and it still is funny, but there are definitely mysteries sort of unraveling and questions that are being answered. And some big things do happen that add some more layers that I was not expecting. But it's a lot of fun. It's just got a great sense of humor and a great sense of just storytelling.
How many episodes are you in?
I am 12 episodes in, and they're short-ish. They're like 19 to 25 minutes each, so not too bad.
Why'd you say 19 instead of 20?
Because a lot of them happen to be 19.
That's interesting. Okay. I was legitimately curious. That was an odd thing.
Yeah. No, but it's fun. The characters, I mean, he's a slacker. I mean, he's like just stupid and kind of, but there's the possibility of he's searching for aliens, but also having to deal with the weird AI that seems to be buggy and, you know, the captain who wants to have talent show that he has nothing to do for. So it's stupid stuff, but it's also serves a purpose. There's just sort of the what you have to do to stay alive and stay sane in being 8 light years away from Earth and cut off with like very little communication.
Multiple voice actors?
Yeah, there's like 3 or 4 different people who do voices on that.
It's essentially like an audio play?
Yeah.
In that sense?
Yeah. There's basically the commander, the communications guy, and then there is a weird doctor.
Okay.
A mad scientist kind of character. And then there's the AI.
Well, having liked Hello from the Magic Tavern, I'll definitely at least give it a shot.
Yeah, and this one I think you have to listen to a couple episodes because it is pretty chock full of humor at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
But as you slowly get further and further, there's more to it.
Okay.
All right.
But yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
So, diverting over to board games. Dave, I think these might have been games you actually played at our tabletop day a few weeks back.
Yeah.
You were going to talk about Takenoko?
Takenoko, yeah. Our good friend Steve Carter ran me through that while he was kind of gearing up to run the demos of Takenoko for it. This is the game in which the I forget whether it's the Chinese emperor.
I think it's the emperor of
Japan
of China?
Or vice versa, but gifts him, I think the Emperor of Japan, a panda.
Yep.
And you are sort of rival caretakers for the panda.
Yeah.
Now, in practice, though, it's actually a light but surprisingly deep strategy game.
Yeah.
In which on your turn you try to. I'm trying to think now that's like a few weeks ago. I remember the specifics. You have tiles of different types of land. You have to like cultivate the garden that it wanders around in. You have to. This is one of those things that like doesn't sound cool, but like you have to irrigate it. You have to get certain tracts of land in certain places and match up what you've got going on in your cards. Everybody has different goals, and the arrangements they're doing of the garden might line up with yours, or they might not. People may inadvertently help you.
Yeah.
You need to grow bamboo for the panda to eat.
Yep.
And there's different colors of bamboo. It reminded me in an overall complexity of something like Settlers of Catan.
Sure.
But it has kind of a more fun theme than cultivating a magical island or whatever.
Right.
There is a panda running around. There's also a gardener guy everybody bounces the panda and the gardener around trying to grow stuff where they want, eat stuff where they want, lay out the rivers and stuff where they want. There's also weather that happens in it that changes things. When there are storms, it scares the panda and he goes running around.
Yep.
Anyway, I had a blast with it. Aside from the fact that it's a visually beautiful game.
Yeah, super cute.
Everybody, like, you know, we were all kind of learning it, but it was a good kind of neck-and-neck contest. At least several of us had a very clear shot at winning. I liked its competition level.
Yeah.
And I also find it's very easy to pick up. I think this would be a good one to run with families and kids and stuff like that. Because it's not a kiddie game by any means, but it's approachable by kids if you teach it to them. Just a high recommendation for that for sort of middle of the road board games. Nothing. And not on the level of Agricola, but certainly more complex than some.
Speaking of Agricola, I played a game this weekend that has a learning curve akin to Agricola. It's called Elysium.
Uh-huh.
I wound up really loving the game. It's a game that's basically the concept is that you're all demigods trying to ascend through the Greek pantheon to become a god. Only one of you will do it, and the way you do it is by buying cards that represent your legend that you build. So you're sort of building, you know, it can be anything from like the Golden Fleece to a Cyclops. And these cards all are represent different families. So there's Hephaestus, there's Athena, all the gods have their different cards. And like Poseidon's cards are all attacky and they attack other people.
Hmm.
And Athena's are all cards that help you. And there's some different mechanics on the cards. But basically what you do is every turn you bid with these four pawns that you have to buy three of what they call legends and then one quest. And the quest determines sort of how much gold you get for the turn and how many things you can move from your domain into your Elysium where it becomes part of your legend.
Okay.
And so it's another one of these. It has you play across, you play sort of five turns, and at the end of five turns you count up all your points to see who has the most points from both completed legends and victory points they've gathered and that kind of stuff. Like I say, very complicated. I can see there's numerous ways to win or lose, but once we got into the play of it, I really, really liked it. I definitely recommend it.
It sounds like thematically it's got a premise that I think will intrigue people.
Yeah, it reminds me of what I liked about something like Seven Wonders, where again, it seems really hard to learn, but once you know it, it's really fun to play. Dave, I know you also played Star Realms.
Yeah, I really liked Star Realms. This is a two-player deck-building game that you can get, like, what's the main game? Is it, like, $20?
$15.
$15, you get the complete game. There are expansions you can buy, just like there are for other deck-building games, like DC Deck Building or Dominion.
Yep.
But you have everything you need for two players just right out of the gate. Your rival Star Empires, you're trying to, you start with just, like, 10 cards, and like all deck-building based games, you start building that deck up, you try and pare it down. But you have four factions of sort of rival intergalactic
empires.
One of them is kind of like the Star Empire is like sort of seems like they could be the bad guys, more Klingon-y.
Yeah.
There's a Federation with a lot of they have a lot of cards that do healing and protection stuff. The Blobs, which are brutes.
The xenomorph type aliens.
Yeah, and they their cards are interesting and often interact with each other. Like, well, in general, if you are start to get one of a certain type, you will want to try and get more of it if you can.
Yeah.
But there's certain cards that are, you know, wildly valuable, and there's a just like in any deck building game, there's a little sort of storefront of cards that you both buy from. So you're competing with the player to get the best stuff for your deck. Sometimes you both want a card. Sometimes it's very clearly more helpful to one person than the other. So you might try and eliminate it through various means. I really liked it. I've only played it a few times. But I did also download the app for it, and I played the crap out of the app while I building up my skills, so the next time I take on my brother, I can crush him and get vengeance.
Yep.
I loved it. It's one of my favorite games I've played this year, and it's very quick to pick up. In fact, one of the things I like about games like DC Deck Building in this is that for the first few hands, your resources are actually so limited that you can only do one or two things. You're like, I can buy this card or this card, and you know, it's very obvious what you need to do in these early stages.
Yep.
Then you start getting a few other cards that may give you some more neat options. And only by the sort of midway and end of the game are you really pulling off the really cool combos, and you can do awesome, amazing combos.
Yes.
I heartily recommend it. I want to try, and it was like, it was a year or two back, it was one of the Buzz games.
Very much so.
Was it ATX or no, what's
it? Gen Con.
Gen Con, yeah. But you know what, they were playing it, at the, like, video, or
South by Southwest?
South by Southwest, yes, that's it. I want to try their fantasy one, Epic, and which I know has different mechanics to it, but I'm curious to try that too.
Okay, moving away from games and into TV, I first want to mention United Shades of America.
Oh yeah,
that is CNN's new show.
Yep,
with comedian W. Kamau Bell.
Yep,
and it's basically he's a black guy. He's a big sort of 6-foot tall black guy.
Yeah.
who's been
long-time. He's got a crazy deep voice. Yeah, like, he should have been the deep voice on The Temptations.
He's a comedian. He's at a nightly show. So this is him basically going into places where he normally wouldn't. So for the first episode, he goes to investigate the KKK.
Yes.
And the second episode, he goes into a prison.
Yep. And this is sort of like, if you've ever seen any of those, like, comedy shows that intersperse, like, say, Chappelle's show.
Yeah.
Intersperse sort of stand-up in front of a small audience.
Yeah.
With, you know, like, clips. That's essentially what he does. He walks you, like, in the Klan one. He meets with any number of Klansmen in it.
Yep.
He goes to some small towns that are known for, like, their Klan presence.
He goes to a cross-lighting.
Yes, and he, like, early on, he's like... And believe it or not, there is humor in this. He's actually extremely funny.
It's funny, and it's also kind of horrifying.
Right.
It's like the best Daily Show segments.
He mentions... Yeah, exactly. That's a good comparison. He mentions that he goes to this crossbreeding, and he's like, now, if you think I'm just going to roll it out now, he's like, you don't know how TV works. That's what we're going to show at the end of the show. And then so they cut around to some other stuff. And he's... It's interesting, because he'll have serious conversations with them. But he joked around, like, there's, at the cross burning, he is joking around with one of these Klansmen who's telling him about, like, oh, the smell of kerosene gets on your clothes, and here's the nickname that they have for that in the Klan and stuff. And you're like, oh, that one guy, for a moment, was almost like a human being.
Yeah. No, most of it, he's talking to them, and these guys are unrepentant racists, that they'll say things to him, and he just kind of rolls with it. It's a fascinating look at a world that you never see.
Well, he also is investigating the sort of the new Klan. There's any number of – several of the people he meet or the groups are sort of trying to rebrand them. As like, they're like, we're not anti-black. We're just pro-white.
Yes.
And so there is that sort of side of them that is trying to be sort of political about it.
Yeah.
They're not going to drop the N-word or something in the middle of a conversation, but a few of them
– Yes, they do.
Do they?
Almost all of them do.
Did they? I didn't remember that. I remember they like use some horrible terminology.
Yes,
but I didn't remember that they were doing that around.
I definitely left this with you. Definitely don't leave it with a oh well, the Klan are human too. That's not what you're going to walk away with. But it's definitely an interesting look. And then when he goes into the prison, he's talking to all these guys, and most of the guys he talked to are like there for murder one. Yeah. And he's talking to the guys who have been there for. You know, they're going to be for the rest of their life. They've been in there for a long time. They've sort of acclimated to it. And it's sort of what it's like to be in this prison. Now, he's at San Quentin, which is, I guess, a level 2 facility. So it's not like Supermax or anything. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of, you know, what is your day-to-day like in prison? You know, what is it like? What's the goal here? Rehabilitation. And and I know later on he talks, you know, he's going to go ride along with the cops. And it's just an interesting look at a side of America you don't see from someone who usually wouldn't see it.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting sort of mix of journalism and comedy.
Yeah. I think he's kind of incisive and funny.
Yeah.
You know, funny when he needs to be, serious when he needs to be.
Yeah. I was really taken with it. Like I say, it gave me the same thing I get when I watch The Daily Show, where I get really, really angry, but at the same time, it's you're glad to know it, and it's also really funny.
Yeah. What's the name of it again?
United Shades of America.
Got it.
It's kind of hard to find on streaming.
Huh.
Like, I don't know.
The first episode was, like, up on YouTube or something.
Yeah, and I think that was a pirated copy.
Oh, was it? Yes. I thought it might be that they were doing that to promote it.
Nope.
Well, poke around a little bit if you haven't seen it. It may be on there or somewhere.
It's worth watching. So, Dave, you and I have both been watching sort of old-school spy shows.
Yeah.
You watched some of The Sandbaggers.
Yeah, The Sandbaggers, which is a British show from, I think, like, early 80s,
okay,
I believe.
Yeah.
That is known to have been an inspiration for Greg Rucka's
Queen and Country,
which is to say it's about, like, real spying from the perspective of the guys who run the operations, which is to say it's not sexy. It is not James Bond stuff. It is very dry. There's a lot of politics involved. It's essentially like – it's like the behind-the-scenes office side of spy, of espionage.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was really, really interesting. In the first episode, and there's a lot of – some of the terminology I picked up, like in Queen and Country, is completely active in here. The head of it is a guy they call D-Ops and Director of Operations. And you do get to know a few of them. There's like 5 sandbaggers. That's the name for their spies. And – A few other characters on the show. The secretary is actually surprisingly notable. She runs a lot of interference for
that very much sounds like Queen and Country.
And manages the politics between and tries to diffuse situations. There's like a member of parliament who, Sandbagger One or whatever, his ex-wife, her father is in parliament and still has a good friendship with this guy. So he communicates to him stuff that's coming from the top down, from like the government to him, and that he needs to be aware of. And occasionally he can also in turn be asked for favors.
Okay.
In the first episode, Diops notices he's being tailed on the way in, or one of his agents is. Now, this is not like super James Bondy tailing. He subtly picks it up that there was a tail. They manage to put hands on the guy, on one of the guys, and find out that they're an agent for a relatively fledgling, like Norwegian spy group. Their own. What do you call these? What do you call MI6 and all that, or MI5?
I don't know. Intelligence
agency. Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. And that they are essentially training and trying to pick up tips from them. And it is not a it's not a ruse. That's the truth. And they sort of exchange their formal information in chat. And these guys are like, you know, solidly equipped. This is still in the middle of the Cold War in the early 80s. But what happens is a spy. They're trying to get in the game. They're trying to be bigger players in it. They have a plane that's been shot down on the Russian side of the border, and they early on in their relationship with the MI5?
I don't know.
I think so. I'm forgetting what they call it because they don't. There's a lot of it's very jargony, but they don't like say this is our organization very often.
Yeah.
But I think it's like MI6 is sort of like one is the FBI and one is CIA.
Yeah.
Anyway, they want their help, and it's a dangerous mission that they would have to be putting their neck out for. But it gets political because there's like a deal for like a missile design that Norway is considering buying from America or the UK. They're both working on a similar missile design. And they are likely to go with probably the person who helps them out on this mission.
Yeah.
And so it becomes super political quick. There's people are not all getting the same information. Eventually see like the actual downed plane and the attempted escort mission.
Mm-hmm.
Things do not go as planned, but it's super interesting. It is also very dry.
This is all one episode?
That's one episode.
Wow.
It's as British as it gets.
Yeah.
Jargon-filled. You may just take a little while to adjust to the accents. They do not fill you in on stuff if you get a little bit behind. So I found myself occasionally pausing, rewinding, like, wait, what did he just indicate in there? But I really like the show. I can see why it made such an impression on Greg Rucka.
This is on Netflix?
No, we were watching it, honestly, on Region Free Player. It was like UK DVDs. Okay. I don't know what its availability is like, to be honest.
All right.
But I've seen like three episodes so far, and every one of them has been good.
Okay. So I've been watching a show on it's a BBCA and Sundance cooperative. I believe it's going to go to Netflix before too long. A show called The Night Manager.
Uh-huh.
This is a John Le Carré book. You know, one of the big spy writers.
Yeah.
And it is starring Tom Hiddleston and Hugh Laurie, as well as Olivia Colman, who you might know from Broadchurch.
Right.
So
who was she in Broadchurch?
She was the female detective.
Okay.
So basically, Night Manager, it's a 6-episode miniseries. Tom Middleton is the night manager of a hotel in Egypt during the Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes involved with a story that revolves around Hugh Laurie's sort of weapons dealer industrialist, who Olivia Colman's MI5 spy describes as the worst person in the world.
Uh-huh.
And basically, he winds up going undercover in his organization. He's a night manager of a hotel, but he used to be military. And he happens across some intelligence and winds up sort of recruited as an asset into the intelligence world.
Uh-huh.
And it's beautifully shot. It's really interesting look at sort of – and this is very much a sort of sexy espionage. He seduces a couple of women. Mm-hmm. There's that relationship stuff that I remember, you know, from any kind of undercover story you've ever seen of like somebody going undercover in the mob or whatever. There's loyalty testing, somebody doesn't believe in him.
Right.
Always
that question of how far will you go to prove yourself, that kind
of
stuff.
A lot of sort of suspense violence, mm-hmm. you know. But it's really, really good. I believe I'm 4 of 6 episodes in. The last – Last two will air this week and next week, and it's really good stuff. I've been enjoying it. If you have any fondness for spy stuff, or if you happen to like Tom Hiddleston, although I don't know if anybody likes that guy.
He's all right.
Or if you're seeing Hugh Laurie play a bad guy, because Hugh Laurie playing British is rare. Usually he plays sort of an American version of himself.
Yeah.
This is House playing his original British guy, and he's very much a sort of a messed up billionaire kind of dude.
Hmm.
But really, really good spy stuff. I highly recommend it. And then turning to video games, I played the beta for Overwatch.
Yep,
which I loved. Did you play a little bit, Dave?
I just dabbled in it. I didn't. I'm not quite in the mood for that kind of like a first person shooter type stuff.
Yeah,
right at the moment.
And Nick, you didn't get a chance to play any of it, right?
No, I didn't get to play any of it.
So I have this coming. It's releasing next week. I'm very excited to play it. It's 21 different characters, and they all play somewhat differently. It is a first-person shooter. It takes place in sort of this world of. It seems like they were sort of a. There was a dangerous world war. If you watch the cinematics, they get into the Overwatch with sort of this team of adventurers and vigilantes and superpowered people, and they all came together to sort of make the world a safer place. Then they disbanded, and now some of them are sort of mercenaries, and they've been called back into action. So it's. That's the premise, but mostly you're sort of battling these everything from cybernetic monkeys to
like an old West. There's like a Clint Eastwood.
There's a Clint Eastwood guy. There's a archer who's sort of a sniper. There's a ninja who's his brother who's sort of cybernetic.
There's that dude who looks like the embodiment of death with twin sawed off shotguns.
There's one of the great characters is Lucio, who's a DJ whose music is sort of a healing and empowering kind of thing.
And who's it? Is it May? She's the chick who looks. She's got
she's
like
sort
the
of
big
Captain Cold-esque.
Yeah, she's got like a giant, oversized parka and a cold gun, which can also she can make cold like ice walls to block enemies. So you have a really wide variety of powers to interact with as you're all out there dueling or running different missions.
Yeah, superpowers and guns, and it's a team matchup, and it's got escorting stuff. It's got hold the fort, hold the throw. King of the Hill type that mechanic, capture the flag type mechanic.
Visually, I was going to say, it looks like, I mean, if you kind of know the Blizzard art style, it's sort of a very vivid, bright colors, but kind of, I would also say Big Hero 6, I feel like was probably an influence on it. There's a little, an anime in general, there's a lot of sort of mech armored suits there.
Yeah.
It's not superheroes quite in the American tradition, but more a little bit leaning a little more Eastern.
Yeah.
This is hitting all consoles, right?
All consoles and PC, yeah.
And is this going to be one of the first games that allows PS4 people to play Xbox?
They're talking about it. I don't believe it's happened yet.
Nobody
but that'd
ever
be
really
nice.
Seems to have nailed that.
Nobody's ever gotten it. I would sure love to be able to play with a wider pool of players. But, yeah, it's a ton of fun. And we do have the Rogues Gallery PS4 group that you can go join. I don't know how easy that is, but I don't know how often we use it. But you know, if you want to play with fellow Rogues people, you can go join that group.
At the end of the month, I have to make a decision between Overwatch and Uncharted 4. So
you should choose Overwatch and play it with me.
You choose Uncharted 4 and let me borrow it when you're done.
Uh-huh. And then, Dave, you played an indie game called Firewatch.
Yes, no relation to Overwatch, even remotely. Although it is technically a first-person game. This is something I ran across, I think, because they were having a sale, and I was browsing through it. And I watched the trailer, and it looked interesting. And then I saw that under the related games, I'm going to blank on it, but there was an indie game that was, like, I think primarily I thought it was a PC game. That I was like, oh, this is something that people have been buzzing about. So I remember hearing about it. Firewatch is a game that in which your character is like a normal guy who's taken a job at one of those tower stations in like a national park where you watch for wildfires and stuff. And before the game even begins, you know you're in weird territory because you're asked a series of questions that felt like Telltale Games type questions.
Okay.
It's walking you through like the dramatic events in your life, like your first sort of serious love in college and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll say something like, you wake up together in bed one night, she's upset because of something, her boss told her, or that her father's dying or something like that. And she's also angry at you because of something you said at a party earlier. And then you have like three choices of how you handle the situation.
Okay.
And they're all, it's like very serious. Like it turns super serious real fast. And, at least, I don't know if this changes, but she has like early, like, onset, like, Alzheimer's or dementia, something like that. Like, because y'all get married and it moves forward, and so to the point where, like, she's, like, you're in your, like, 40s, like, early 40s. And essentially what it sets up is that this job is, like, probably you trying to go kind of clear your head, find yourself, etc. The heart of the game is walking around in this forest, not, like, in some random way, but you do sort of always have stuff to do. You're in communication. You're the new person. You're in communication with a lady in the top next tower over, and there's really strong dialogue between the characters, really well-written adult sort of dialogue. They're smart-ass, and there's great banter between them. So the game actually, after that very serious opening, has lots of humor in it. But, like, the very first thing that happens is she notices some kids that are setting off fireworks in an area of the park, sends you out to go confront them and scare the crap out of them. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of zen-type thing of kind of wandering through the park at times. And then there's these kind of, like, interesting altercations where you do have these sort of, what I would say, Telltale Games-type choices to make of dialogue. And there's interacting with the other sort of Firewatch person. And then there is a strange mystery going on, which I would almost compare to, like, some of the weirdness of Lost, in a way.
Okay.
That is ultimately resolved, but there's some weird stuff, some mysteries going on at the park. It moves forward in time, sometimes by a few days, sometimes by, like, a month or two. And as you kind of decide where your character's headspace is going, because it's also about that. I really, really liked it. This is obviously not a game for everyone, but I think people should check out the trailer if it sounds interesting. If you kind of like more chill games, if you're not in the mood to blow stuff up, it's indie, so the graphics are not great, but they're pretty nice for what they do with it. I really liked it.
All right, that about wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo-jo!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.